is home to one of the worst human rights crises of our time.
The top U.S. diplomat speaks out against what China is doing in Xinjiang. This is Friday, July 19th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, what appears to be arson takes at least 33 lives in Japan. An international warning of increased hunger, malnutrition, and waterborne diseases in North Korea due to a poor early harvest. And tough times for India's car salespeople. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo criticized the Chinese government Thursday. Pompeo's comments came in his keynote address on the final day of the three-day Ministerial to Advanced Religious Freedom hosted by the State Department. The top U.S. diplomat used Beijing's crackdown on the Uyghurs in China's autonomous Xinjiang region as an example of religious persecution in the world.
China is home to one of the worst human rights crises of our time. It is truly the stain of the century. Since April 2017, the Chinese government has detained more than 1 million Chinese Muslims and other minorities in camps in Xinjiang.
Four Chinese nationals were among 27 representatives of persecuted religious groups in Washington for the conference. They met Wednesday at the White House with President Donald Trump. China's foreign ministry spokesman Liu Kang Thursday took exception to that visit and called on the United States to stop interfering in its internal affairs. Liu Kang said, "I must point out that there is no so-called religious persecution in China. Chinese citizens enjoy freedom of religious belief according to law. It was an act to interfere with China's internal affairs that the United States arranged members of the heretical Falun Gong and people who tarnish China's religious freedom to attend a so-called religious meeting and made them meet the U.S. leader." China expresses strong dissatisfaction with and resolute opposition to this. We urge the United States to correctly view China's religious policies and freedom and stop interfering with other countries' internal affairs using religion as an excuse. The Secretary of State also announced Thursday the creation of the International Religious Freedom Alliance, an effort he described as intended to bring like-minded countries together to confront challenges of international religious freedom and defend human rights. Coming up on VOA Asia, a deeper look at what China is doing with its Xinjiang population. These are among some of the top stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. India's space agency says it will make a second attempt to launch an unmanned probe to the moon's south pole next Monday, July 22nd. Asia and the Pacific region seem likely to miss all 17 goals of the UN's 2030 agenda for sustainable development, according to a senior official in charge of the region. In fact, on some of those goals, like access to clean water and sanitation, and others, countries are actually faring worse. South Korean political parties backed their government in a Japanese trade confrontation. China made its biggest purchase of U.S. sorghum since last April, last week, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture data issued on Thursday. This is VOA Asia. China's Belt and Road Initiative aims to build an economic and trade network across much of the world. To reach areas outside of mainland China, Beijing is utilizing a corridor through western Xinjiang province. There, more than a million Uyghurs, members of a Turkic-speaking Muslim minority in China, currently being targeted in Xinjiang in an effort that Beijing sees as protecting interests like Belt and Road for its majority Han population. Uyghurs are being held in internment camps, referred to as concentration camps by human rights organizations and former detainees, while Chinese officials describe them as vocational education centers for job training. Sophie Richardson, China Director at Human Rights Watch, and Olivia Enos, Senior Policy Analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, joined VOA's Carol Castiel in our weekly program Encounter. They discussed how some of the surveillance techniques used in Xinjiang are beginning to make their way along the so-called New Silk Road to other areas with authoritarian regimes.
The Belt and Road Initiative is China's primary economic initiative. It's not the only one, but it's really this extension and outreach to countries beyond its borders. And I think one of the really terrifying aspects of the Belt and Road Initiative is that they're using that Belt and Road in order to export surveillance technology and also to export a form of authoritarianism that's incredibly pernicious. And, you know, I will give one example in the context of Africa. In Zimbabwe, the Chinese SOE, state-owned enterprise, provided surveillance technology to the Zimbabwean government. And they not only deployed that to use against their own citizens in Zimbabwe, but they made an arrangement with the Zimbabwean government where the Chinese state-owned enterprise gets the private data of individual Zimbabwean citizens, unbeknownst to these citizens, and is using it to, as one report put it, quote, refine their technology on darker skin tones so that they can surveil better. This is terrifying. And this is the type of activities that aren't just happening in Africa, it's happening in Latin America. And in fact, Chinese police are training police forces in New Zealand, police forces in Germany. This is extending far beyond its borders, and the Belt and Road Initiative is just one mechanism for exporting that form of surveillance technology as a means of authoritarianism, and we should be very worried.
Yeah, we have been writing for the last couple of years about the abuses of different kinds of surveillance technology. We wrote about predictive policing platforms and how they're used across China, about facial recognition, about the compulsory collection of biodata without giving people the opportunity to opt out of it. And when we started to look at how technology was being used, particularly in Xinjiang, we kept seeing references to something called the Integrated Joint Operations Platform. And when we broke this apart, we came to realize that it identified 36 different types of behavior, almost none of which were actually illegal. You were now considered suspicious if, for example, you suddenly started going out the front door of your house instead of the back door of your house. And a whole supporting architecture of surveillance technology, from CCTV cameras to Wi-Fi sniffers, feeds this information into the IGOP system. And all of this information is getting hoovered up into this particular platform, and it tells police who to go out and question, and in some cases, actually detain, for perfectly legal behavior.
Back to you, Olivia, with respect to the United States, what its position is with regard to this is there's a convergence, a bipartisan consensus that this action that the Chinese are taking is absolutely abhorrent, and that there is a new Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act in the House and the Senate, sanctioning officials under the Magnitsky Act and or restricting export of technologies used for repression. What more can you add to that, and where does the Trump administration stand?
So you've seen officials from the Trump administration issuing highly condemning language when it comes to what's going on in Xinjiang, anywhere from the vice president to Secretary Pompeo to Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback. You have seen these statements coming. But where's the action? This has been really concerning, that really the only elements of the U.S. government to even consider action is Congress, which is great. It's great that Congress is seeking to hold the administration accountable and to make sure that we can use the elements and the instruments of foreign policy to hold China accountable for what's going on. And yet we still haven't seen any global Magnitsky sanctions, as you referenced. Global Magnitsky can be issued based off of violations of human rights or corruption. It's important that those individuals, especially Chen Guangguo, who we know is responsible for architecting the police state in Xinjiang, but also previously in Tibet, holding him accountable seems like a no-brainer to me. As you also referenced, of course, you can hold individual businesses accountable, just the potential threat of the U.S. targeting businesses who provide the surveillance technology led to Thermo Fisher Scientific discontinuing its exports of surveillance technology to China. Really positive step. But I think there is a need to really put pressure and continue to elevate these things. The question is just when they will act.
Olivia Enos, the senior policy analyst in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Sophie Richardson, China director at Human Rights Watch, speaking with Carol Castiel. The full discussion, you can hear it on Encounter, and you can find it on our audio programs page online at voanews.com. A Japanese fire official says the death toll from a Kyoto animation studio fire is now 33. They say nobody else is believed to still be missing. A Kyoto fire department official says 36 others have been injured, 10 of them critically. Reuters' Mia Womersley has more.
Billowing smoke and shocked bystanders, fire swept through an animation studio in Japan on Thursday. It's thought the blaze in the city of Kyoto was an arson attack. And the main suspect is a man who shouted "die" as he doused the building with petrol. Authorities said scores were also injured when the building was torched. The studio produces popular series such as Sound Euphonium. Its Free Road to the World, The Dream movie is due for release this month. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called the fire too appalling for words on Twitter and offered condolences to the victims. Public broadcaster NHK said police have taken a 41-year-old man into custody.
That was Reuters reporter Mia Womersley. Happening now in Asia, Australia says it has learned a dual Chinese-Australian dissident and writer who has been detained in his native country since January has been moved to a detention center in Beijing. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says that Yang Hanjun is facing possible charges of endangering state security. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is warning about increased hunger, malnutrition, and waterborne diseases in North Korea due to a poor early harvest. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
North Korea's expected June to September harvest has been cut in half due to an early spring drought. The International Red Cross Federation reports the destruction of crops is having a devastating impact on thousands of the most vulnerable people. It says the elderly, families with young children, breastfeeding mothers, those suffering from chronic illnesses or disabilities are in desperate need. Red Cross spokesman Matthew Cochran tells VOA the humanitarian situation for many communities across North Korea is extremely critical. He says the UN estimates more than 40% of the population, around 11 million people, is in need of food aid.
It has been and remains one of the world's truly silent humanitarian emergencies. The work that we're doing now really is about trying to help very vulnerable communities survive the coming weeks and months, but it's a drop in the ocean, I think, and much more support is needed.
Cochran says 20% of North Korea's children are malnourished. He warns the current food crisis is likely to lead to rising malnutrition rates and waterborne diseases such as diarrhea and colitis.
Often you see in a drought situation where obviously there's a lack of water, the water that is available is polluted, is not really fit for human consumption, but people really have no choice but to consume that water. So by providing clean water, not just for the crops, but also for the people, we hope to have the added benefit of improving crop yields and improving food security, but also helping protect people against waterborne illnesses.
The Red Cross Federation is appealing for nearly $500,000 to provide life-saving assistance for thousands of people living in the most affected communities in North Pyongan province. Given the severity of the situation, it says quick action is needed to save what can be saved from the failed harvest and to ensure that people whose food stocks are almost gone do not go hungry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, too many new automobiles in India. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, Taliban insurgents assaulted a provincial police headquarters Thursday in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 12 people, wounding more than 60 others. Officials said multiple heavily armed men wearing suicide vests stormed the well-guarded building in the center of Kandahar at about 5 p.m. local time. You're listening to VOA Asia. Just a year ago, India was forecast to become the world's third largest automobile market, overtaking Japan, but the industry is now grappling with its worst slump in over a decade. As Anjana Pasricha reports from Gurgaon, a business hub near New Delhi, the plummeting fortunes of the $100 billion auto industry reflect a broader slowdown in India's economy, which grew at its slowest pace in nearly 5 years in the first quarter of the year.
At a Hyundai showroom at Gurgaon, this college student is helping his elder brother decide what car to buy in exchange for their old vehicle.
Our old car is around 10 to 11 years old, and since you cannot drive a car older than 15 years in Delhi, we decided to change it now to get a decent price.
Auto dealers are enticing customers with deals, new models, and attractive prices as they grapple with plunging sales in recent months.
There's a drop of around 25% to 30%, at least. Like a dealer who used to sell around 150 cars, he has come to around 110, 115. Same is with us also.
Eyeing India's growing car market, global automakers had expanded operations over the last two decades. Booming sales made the industry the most conspicuous sign of the country's economic potential. But in the past year, an aspirational middle class has cut back on purchases of everything from cars to other goods as the economy loses momentum. That has prompted several car makers, including India's biggest, Maruti Suzuki, to cut production. And while this car dealership is keeping its four showrooms up and running, many others are not so lucky.
The salaries are going up, the infrastructure costs are the same, and with low sales, it definitely makes it difficult, not viable even to run the showrooms. That's why you see all around many showrooms being closed down. Many showrooms.
Economists say the auto industry's woes reflect a broader slowdown that has been gradually building up.
We didn't do enough to increase the demand to put the economy back on track. Remember, we are a domestic consumption-driven economy. We are not dependent on exports.
India's ailing rural sector, which had emerged as a big market as farmers switched from motorcycles to cars, has also adversely affected automakers.
So if one, two-thirds of our economy is actually going through a slowdown, then the remaining one-third cannot sustain it for long. And why? Finally, what we are seeing is what has spilled over after 2 or 3 years of sustained neglect of the rural economy.
Stuck in the slow lane, the auto industry is hoping for the economy to pick up to revive its fortunes. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Gurgaon.
This news break from VOA Asia. Anti-corruption officials in Pakistan have arrested former Prime Minister Shahid Hakan Abbasi for allegedly evading an ongoing investigation into corruption charges against him. You can find out more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Australia's annual influenza season started unusually early in 2019, and already there are more than 144,000 confirmed cases. At least 231 people have died so far, including some children, although the vast majority of victims were frail, elderly Australians. Many experts are blaming a virulent strain of the flu virus for an early start to the influenza season. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
The year 2019 is likely to be one of Australia's most severe periods of the highly contagious respiratory illness. With more than 144,000 confirmed cases of influenza, the government, worried about a vaccine shortage, has ordered an extra 400,000 doses. Dr. Chris Zappala, Vice President of the Australian Medical Association, hopes the community can cope.
We've had millions and millions of vaccines through the country already, and we hope it's enough. I think we can put some trust in the epidemiologists who do this every year. Remember, what's happened here is we've got an extremely wily organism that mutates and makes things difficult.
Multiple flu viruses circulate each year, and they're broadly grouped into two types, A and B. A particularly potent strain may well be to blame for an early start to Australia's influenza season. Experts hope it will finish before its usual peak in August, the last month of winter. But Professor Brendan Murphy, Australia's chief medical officer, says it's hard to tell.
The one thing you can say definitely about flu is you can't predict. This season may be a very early season that may fade away and not have the big late winter peak, or it may continue. We just don't know. That's why we recommend everybody get vaccinated and be prepared.
Australia suffered its worst flu season on record in 2017, when more than 250,000 cases were reported. More than 1,100 people died, slightly less than those killed in road accidents. The government recommends that every Australian over the age of 6 months should get a flu shot every year. Flu season in Australia usually runs from June to September, peaking in August. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Trading starts Monday on a Chinese stock market for high-tech companies that play a key role in official development plans that are straining relations with Washington. Regulators have approved 25 companies in information technology and other fields seen by communist leaders as a path to prosperity and global influence for the Shanghai Stock Exchange's Star Market. The market, modeled on the U.S.-based NASDAQ, reflects the ruling Communist Party's desire to channel private capital into its development plans. It gives small Chinese investors a chance to buy into tech industries that have mostly turned to Wall Street to sell its shares. People everywhere love competition, and the subject is, at times, not that important. Championships are awarded in things like toe wrestling, speed burger eating, and mobile phone throwing. Well, the Michigan city of Eau Claire has one of its own, the annual Cherry Pit Spitting Championship. Roman Verkowski visited the town to see how far the love of pit spitting stretches. Anna Rice narrates his story.
Eau Claire's Cherry Pit Spitting Championship began nearly a half century ago. These days attracts professional spitters from all over the world, eager to demonstrate their skill. Many competitors come every year, like 2019 champion Kevin Bartz, whose victorious spit was an amazing 16 and a half meters.
I actually started when I was 10 years old. My dad was a cherry pit spitter. He'd worked in the fields and things like that.
The cherry pit spit is open to anybody. It's free in the morning starting about 10 o'clock. People arrive and they queue up and they spit their pits. And based on those results, by noon, we determine the top 10 people in each of the age categories, as you see right behind me.
In addition to the regular rules, which differ slightly with each category of participants, there are also the less serious rules, which include bans on gunpowder, kerosene, and fire. And don't even think about spitting the cherry pit through your nose.
I personally think it's kind of fun. My mother doesn't think that her daughter should know how to spit a cherry pit, as it's not very ladylike, but I enjoyed the fact that my dad taught me, and it's a fun thing to do to come out here.
2019 marked the 46th anniversary of the championship. For organizer Lynn Sage, it is a family tradition. Her father came up with the idea for the competition decades ago.
Back in 1974, Dad was looking for something to do with cherry pits. You eat a cherry, and there's this pit, and there's nothing more natural than to spit it. You can spit a watermelon seed. You can maybe toss an apricot pit. But we've stuck with the cherry pit spitting.
Sage continued the tradition and says the championship never fails to draw a crowd. After all, it's not every day that you get a chance to receive a prize for some good spitting. For Roman Verkhovsky in Eau Claire, Michigan, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Are you one who ever thought of spitting a pit through your nose? Not me. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Zainab Abdel Rahman, and our team, our managing editor Diane Gao, our VOA team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. My name's Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Enjoy your day and your weekend.